Here we go.
Welcome to BP Wrigleycast, the Cubs podcast that looks at the game from both the analytical perspective and the fan's point of view. Joining me tonight is Isaac Bennett, Ryan Davis, and unfortunately, Joel has started a new career in the speech writing business. We can't tell you much more than that, other than the speech that he's writing right now, probably. He's got a deadline for Friday. Is a big name, big name. I mean, you could almost use an adjective for something even bigger. Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a huge name.
It's a bigly job.
Yeah, he's writing the best speeches.
A lot of copying and pasting from what we hear. But either way, it's still work is work, and we do what we got to do. But anyway, thanks for joining me, guys. Well, let's get into the baseball and get away from this ghastly topic of politics. Baseball Prospectus released their Pecota projections yesterday, day before yesterday, this week. So we're gonna take a look at, we're gonna dip into kind of how the Cubs fared and some individual players and things that we find interesting. So right off the bat, Isaac, I'll start with you. Anything surprising in what you saw, not just in the standings, but in terms of Cubs specific players?
Well, there's always a lot to digest here. And I think that the thing that I found very most interesting, because this is probably the biggest island that I'm all alone, you know, nude sunbathing on right now. I think the Cardinals made a mistake this offseason. Yeah, yeah.
You think you're all alone?
That's weird, Ryan. I know that you've had some strange fetishes for me, but that's strange. I think that the Cardinals made a mistake this offseason. I think that they should have used their time to shed themselves of some of their many valuable old veterans and try and complement their young core a little bit better for a run starting 2 years from now. Pecota apparently is joining me on my little colony here because they have the Cardinals losing 86 games in 2017. Now, I thought I was bearish on them, and this is a whole different level than anything that I had been thinking. So, Pecota hates this team, and I haven't really dug in too far to know why, other than the fact that they may or may not have hacked into their servers to find out that they no longer have inside information. But no, I found that very interesting. I found it pretty interesting that the Dodgers were projected 7 games better than the Cubs. I think that maybe reflects a little bit in that they like their pitching depth a little bit more, and the West might be a little bit weaker than the Central 1-5. So there could be some difference there. But
I have to interrupt you there because we started kind of joking a little bit about politics, and then I asked you, hey, what do you think about the Cubs and the Pecota projections? And I got a very political answer, railing on this other team that's got nothing to do with the Cubs.
I'm getting there.
So I just had to point that out.
Yeah, you never want to get Ryan Davis and I talking politics together. Always a bad way to go.
It's a no-spin rate zone here.
If you gave me, an over-under on the Cubs at 91 wins, I would bet my life savings and mortgage my house 3 times over to take the over. This is not a 91-win team. These projections have zero upside baked into this team. They've got Chris Bryant at a 5.2 warp. His over-under is about 7. They've got Anthony Rizzo at 4.1. His over-under is 5. They've got Wilson Contreras at 2.2. His over-under is 3. They've got Addison Russell at 2.6. His over-under is about 4. So there is zero upside baked into a team that started 5 24-year-old or younger players last year. So I think the Cubs over-under wins is probably about 95.5. And I think this is a very, very tepid prognostication for this team.
Didn't Pecota have them at like 89 wins or something like that last year? Or maybe that was the Vegas number. Maybe the Vegas number was like 89.5 for the Cubs. Absurdly low, and thinking, man, I really should put some money on the Cubs regular season total. But I didn't. looking at the Pecota projections, I guess, if I'm taking a look at the overall league, one that jumped out to me is the White Sox. They have them at 76 wins, I think, down from there quite a bit. And really, I mean, it's unfair to Pecota that they have to project that team for an entire season. I think if they held that team together, maybe 72 to 74 wins would be okay. But Jose Quintana, Todd Frazier, probably a handful of others, David Robertson, those guys are going to be traded at some point this season, and that team's going to bottom out really to the 2012-2013 Cubs. So the White Sox are probably going to come in maybe 15 wins under their projection. That was a lot. Yeah.
I'm not a mathematician, but I think that's 61 and 101.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, they're close to 100 loss team, I think, by the end of the season. Not right now. The team they have together right now is a 72-73 win team. But yeah, they're going to bottom out by the end of the year, which is what they absolutely 100% should do. It's the right thing for them to do at this point. So, stuck out to me. The Cardinals obviously stuck out to me. I think they probably come in 10 wins over their projection, around 85, 86, 87 wins. Not that I'm a huge fan of what they've done with their roster. I think adding Dexter Fowler makes them better. I think having Alex Reyes in their rotation makes them better. I like the rotation today better than I did a year ago today. So I do think they're at least an 86, 87 win team. But yeah, that I don't see anything too egregious with Pecota. I mean, they didn't predict the Cubs for great things last year. They didn't predict the Cubs again for great things this year. What, 91? I think the update. Did Pecota standings has them at 92 victories. Yeah, 92 and 70 as of right now. So probably 5-6 wins away from where the regular season total ends up. I want to say 90 is probably a bunch of players, and then they had to call up guys like Mark Zagunas and kind of like plug and play. Then I think probably 89, 90 victories. But we can't assume that. We have to assume the team will be healthy.
I always find myself, every time these projections come out, any projections come out, because of when they come out, I'm like, ooh, stats, fresh stats that I haven't seen before. And I'm scrambling and I'm looking and I'm all excited. And then I realize it's projections. So I don't, you know, I lose the enthusiasm very quickly. But there's some players that I do find, you know, right away, I was like, okay, well, what does it think Jason Hayward's going to do? He had such a weird season, so what's Hayward going to do? And they've got Hayward for the third highest WARP on the team, which is amazing to think. But I was like, oh, okay, well, that's good, because I'm an optimist too. So let's go Hayward. the other thing I thought was interesting, and I think it was pointed out in a Wrigleyville article this week, was Almora getting so few at bats, so few plate appearances according to these projections, which I mean, that kind of confused me a little bit. I think it's only got 193 plate appearances for the season. I thought that was kind of interesting. And then the other one, obviously, that I was the because it's a weird case, is Kyle Schwarber, just, you know, going from basically no action at all last year to a full season and getting almost 600 plate appearances and 31 home runs. It's like, all right. And it does make you wonder, Isaac, it's a good point that there's no upside baked into this. Some of the young players, like your boy Addison Russell, just seems to be like flat to down, when really these are young players that are still kind of figuring stuff out. So it's interesting to see how these numbers crunch out and what they think is going to happen.
Yeah. And these projections are made as a, with smoothing in mind, you know, so they're not baking an upside.
Sounds sexy.
Trying to do. Yeah. Well, I do what I can, but I just look at a guy like Russell, who clearly towards the end of the year was making huge strides at the plate, and especially, he's 23 years old, just turned 23 this in January, and he came very close to having a 4 WARP in his first full season last year. So when you look at a projection at, you know, 2.6, taking a big step back from where he was last year as a 22-year-old, I don't think that's not even not baking an upside. I think that is clearly towards the downside. I think that is about a worst case scenario if he plays the whole season. So, you know, I don't take it too seriously. I think it's a good projection system, but this team is not seven games worse than the LA Dodgers. There's no way that you're going to put Rizzo and Bryant in the middle of an order and be seven games worse than that team. It's simply not happening. That's a plateau of two MVP caliber players that you simply can't match on the other side and you can't overcome. I mean, I like that Dodgers team a lot, but I like the Cubs more. And I just don't see it. I think that this team has still offensive potential that is, I don't think anybody is still appreciating quite what their offensive potential is. There's so much talent and there's so many things went wrong last year. I mean, you got nothing out of an $180 million free agent, not less than nothing. He was negative value and you lost your third best hitter for the entire season. And, you know, a lot went wrong there. And the team won 103 games. So you're going to see regression in the pitching staff. And I think that shows up in these projections some. I think the pitching projections are pretty close to spot on. But I see way more upside in the offense than it's baking in.
And you know, one thing I also wanted to mention is it's interesting to note, you know, Miguel Montero, according to the projections, is just a step away from just retiring, according to this, only getting 136 plate appearances, which begs the question, who else is going to catch? And Pakoda's got Victor Caratini on there, which I doubt he'll get even as many plate appearances they've got here. But does it bring up any concerns about, okay, yeah, if Miguel Montero really is washed up, done, who helps take some of the load off Wilson Contreras' shoulders during the season?
I would think that Caratini right now is probably that third guy.
Oh, you think so?
Because there's just nobody else. Yeah, I mean, there's nobody else in the system that's that close to the major leagues. And maybe they, you know, have a non-roster invitation guy that they end up signing, sending them to AAA. I mean, that show up the Tim Fedorovich type guy. So that's maybe who that guy is if they just decide Caratini couldn't come up and do that. I mean, Montero is going to end up on the DL at some point, and you're going to have a backup catcher ready. Contreras isn't going to catch 162 games. What I've been looking at with this is it's for 516 plate appearances with 17 home runs, a 343 on base, and a 440 slugging. So that's almost an 800 with 17 homers in, you know, less than 600 plate appearances, and they have him for 2.2 warp. That seems a bit low. I'm guessing that despite being a negative framer last year, that maybe BP is not as high on him this year.
Well, I almost guarantee you this is all a framing metric, because if you remember last year and the overall projections, and I don't know that we're going to get into this tonight, but Yasmani Grandal, who's a very good player. Don't hear me wrong, but he was fourth.
Do you still have that framed picture of him in your bedroom?
Yeah, he was fourth on the projected overall across all of Major League Baseball, and a huge component of that was framing. So it does not break it out, at least with the list that I'm looking at here. But to your point, you're talking about a guy that's OPSing nearly 800 and hitting well above average at his position and being only, you know, a game over average, essentially, from a warp standpoint. So Contreras is probably getting dinged about a win and a half to two wins in warp. Probably, we'll say a win and a half to be conservative on the framing. And I'll tell you what, y'all can have all the other framers and all the other guys that have the nuance of the position. I will take Wilson Contreras and his bat and be happy all day long.
Can you say that one more time?
Just all while I giggle. Day long. Yes, give me Wilson.
it's got him at a minus -8 FRA.
So that's a win, basically.
Yeah, that's not good.
But that's not
like,
just
he was like a plus +3 last year.
Yeah, 3.6.
That's everything. That's everything, though. So my bet is that his arm is and blocking are plus in that equation, and that his framing metrics are even more negative than minus -8. I bet it's close to double that. So they're probably docking him about a game and a half in framing alone.
Which is interesting because his framing at the major league level last year was positive. It was good. So,
yeah, I don't know that you can watch him and actually make the argument that it was good. I'm not sure what the metric is doing with that, but I don't think his glove work is fantastic from a receiving standpoint. But as always, I will just constantly and consistently refute how much of that is on the catcher from a standpoint of runs saved. So I don't know. I'm thrilled to have him. I think he's one of the best hitting catchers in the National League and across all of Major League Baseball. His arm controls the running game as well as just about any catcher out there, and he blocks just about everything. So love the guy.
Well, when you guys look at these projections, how do you are there any specific questions or things that you wonder about, or the first player that you check? Like, how do you guys look at this in a useful way, or is it just kind of that's interesting, move on?
Yeah, that's kind of how I see it. It's just kind of that's interesting. I wrote this. We did kind of a roundtable discussion on FanRag Sports today, where a few of us discussed the Pecota projections. And the final question was basically, you know, what do you take away from Pecota? And my answer was, even the people who create it know it's just a projection. It's taken way too seriously on both sides of the aisle. There are the people who just absolutely live by this and say, well, Pecota says the Cardinals are a 76-win team, so I believe they're a 76-win team. And then there's other people who are just like, but Pecota's always wrong, blah, 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 blah.
And Royals fans, let's be honest.
And, hey, Pecota is what the games would be if they were played on paper. Everybody knows, whether you are a stat nerd or an old-timer, that games are not played on paper. It's understood. It's baked into the whole thing. We get it. These are just projections about what it should look like in like a vacuum. But the game, obviously there's the human element and there's so many other things. There's injuries and there's, you know, one of the other writers pointed out, you know, very correctly, Pecota doesn't factor in a guy who maybe had a personal struggle last year and came in this year and has his head clear and has developed a new pitch that nobody really knows about, or, you know, any sort of thing. That's where I stand with Pecota. I like it as a projection system. I think it's fun to look at for the same reason Carlos mentioned, because it's like, ooh, new stats. Yay. But beyond that, like, I generally don't think about it too much as the season goes along. And I'm even hard pressed at the end of the year to remember to go back and look and see who Pecota was right about and who they were wrong about.
Well, you know what? Let me take a slight detour then. We can stop talking about Pecota if it's just like, oh, that's interesting, move on. One thing that we didn't plan on talking about, but I'm curious to hear what you guys think about, you know, I think it was a year ago, maybe to the month or ish, when it was catching day at Pecota and all the framing stuff came out. We're all very excited. So I believe it was last week that it was this idea of the pitching tunnels came out. Did you guys read this stuff?
I haven't really dug into it yet. I do know that Matthew Trueblood and I talked about it a little bit, and he conceded, that's the wrong word, he suggested that some of the guys up there, that one of my main points is that I think oftentimes it's the reputation of the pitcher and their ability to control the edges of the zones consistently, mm-hmm. which actually affects framing stats more than a catcher will, as one of the things that can help control it. And he said, this isn't verbatim, so I apologize, Matthew, if you're listening, but he said something to the effect of, you'll be very pleased to know that Hendricks and his pitch tunneling and his ability to control the edges ranks extremely high across all of these, so he's doing his catcher a lot of favors. And what's exciting to me about this is that it's an 1,000-piece puzzle, mm-hmm. and we had been basing all of these stats and runs and wins based on 10 of the pieces. And we just had one tiny little corner of the puzzle put together. And some of the work that the guys over at BP have done with pitch tunneling and some of the other metrics that they've come out with, I think they just added 30 or 40 pieces to the puzzle. So where before I thought we were, you know, 1 or 2% the way to actually understanding the relationship between a pitcher, catcher, and umpire and outside factors, I think that we've added 3 or 4% to what we know about it. So I'm thrilled to see it. And I think this lends towards, hey, there's a lot that we don't know about this. And we probably over-associated run saving with the way a catcher receives the ball or moves himself or allows the umpire to have a sight line or any of these things that we'd contributed so many runs to, you know, we with quotation marks. So I think it's very exciting, and I'm very, very eager to find some time to really dig into the findings and the research that they've done.
Yeah, I'll try to give a quick explanation of what it is for readers that haven't gotten to this. But essentially what they're trying to quantify and measure is this idea that on consecutive pitches, you know, the way that a hitter sees a pitch coming and has there's a certain point at which is the latest that they can react, right? The pitch gets to a certain point, 23.8 feet from home plate is kind of biologically when a player can still react. And so what they're trying to do here is say, when you get one pitch and it's coming through that tunnel, right, you envision kind of a matrix like bullet going through the air and leaving this tunnel in its wake, is when you throw a pitch that moves beyond that point, you're creating a tunnel that looks just like the previous pitch and then deviates from that tunnel. And that's, you know, the whole idea of pitching being the interruption of the hitter's timing. This is this tunnel. And the first time I heard about this whole thing, I was just blown away because I had never thought about it in this way. But, you know, as a player, when you play, and it makes total sense that when you're seeing a pitch and it looks just like the pitch that was in that same exact spot and all of a sudden it moves and does something else, you know, yeah, you might get some contact, but it's going to be much harder to kind of square that pitch up. So really, really encourage readers to take the time. It can get heavy in places, but just the conceit of trying to measure this and put this into numbers is fascinating to me. Ryan, what was your take on this?
I was letting you guys talk because I haven't had time to dig into it yet. I'm aware of it and basically as not as much as you guys just talked about it, but I was aware of, you know, kind of what you were just talking about, Carlos, that tunnel and the whole idea of the pitch looking exactly the same and until it moves at a certain moment and figuring out that moment. Far as beyond that, I haven't dug into it yet. So I don't have anything interesting to say about it, but I look forward to digging into it when I have some time because it does look really interesting.
Yeah, maybe next time that we get together, we'll discuss this because Kyle Hendricks does feature prominently in kind of the leaderboards for some of this new data. So maybe we'll put that off for another day and we'll discuss it then. But while we're talking about pitching, we've probably complained. If we had to list the things that we've complained the most about, besides Joel, it'd probably start with Jason Hayward's 2016 season. And then soon after that, lack of young, controllable starting pitching depth. And we've been hammering that point for a long time. When Jorge Soler got traded for a year of Wade Davis, we thought, wow, well, there goes that trade chip to get that elusive starter. And all of a sudden, we're finding ourselves with all these moves, the most recent of which was today. The Cubs traded for Alec Mills from the Royals in exchange for Donnie DeWeese. DeWeese, I think, is how you pronounce it. I'm not sure. So here's a guy who's got options left, right-handed pitcher, starter. Then we've got, I'm just going to rattle off names, Eddie Butler, Brett Anderson, Williams Perez, Dylan Floro, Casey Kelly. Those last few names are kind of more of the, hey, quantity is better than quality. But when you're talking about this Alec Mills guy, Eddie Butler, Brett Anderson, you've got guys that have pitched in the major leagues, can go up and down if need be. So I want to dig into these guys a little bit more. But let's start with Alec Mills, a guy who just was traded for today. Ryan, I know you've had some conversations with some Royals folks on Alec Mills. So why don't you tell us what you got from him?
Yeah, I talked to Clint Scholes from Steady, who actually put up an interview this morning on their site, which I suggest all fans, if you're interested in Alec Mills, go check that out. He has some interesting things to say. But I also talked to Clint just getting kind of a rundown of what to know about Alec Mills, and he said basically low 90s pitcher, good changeup, has really good control, doesn't have a great breaking ball, not a bullpen piece, and probably a number five starter so kind of what it, you know, considering what they gave up, kind of what you kind of assumed, not a guy who's going to come in and be, you know, Jake Arrieta, but that's the long and the short of it with him. As far as the interview that he did with him, you find out he's kind of a cerebral guy. He engineering.
Dartmouth?
No, he went to, I lost it, UT Martin. But yeah, some of his answers, you can tell he's kind of cerebral. So I think that's pretty interesting. There's not a whole lot in there about his specific performance. It does mention that he had Tommy John surgery back in 2012. Overall, assuming guy, but the plus control, which shows up in his stats and his walk rate, and the fact that he's low 90s and has a good changeup. I think he has a good sinker. Might get to be a ground ball guy. I think that fits well for the Cubs. Obviously, we trust Theo Epstein to be doing the right thing. So when I saw that they got him, I kind of was just like, okay, so this is a ground ball guy then. And sure enough. So yeah, if I'm rating the move, I say two thumbs up.
It's crazy. Because Hendricks is so top of mind to us after the season he had. But when I read, this was from the Royals top prospect list on Baseball Prospectus. They had kind of some other guys to think about, and it was, you know, rather unassuming on the mound, above average sinker and changeup. He's great, great control. And there was one other thing I can't find now, but it was just like, it just kept screaming Hendricks, like, whatever. He's got good, good control, a developing curveball, but above average changeup. I'm like, oh my God, can we get any closer to some Ivy League school would have topped it. But this was somebody that they gave up, a guy they drafted, 2 years ago, outfielder in Deweese. So, and this was, they grabbed Alec Mills, who was about to, was designated for assignment or something. Mm-hmm. So they jumped right on him. Yeah. And so there's more depth there. We have this guy, there's Zastrzyzny, who could also be using that kind of role of going up and down. Pierce Johnson, if he can stay healthy, would probably be in the mix. Let's talk a little bit about Eddie Butler, because, this was another guy that, because of his crossfire release right away, you started hearing, Arrieta reclamation project, quite a bit of upside. But he's got his own issues. So, I hate to say this over and over again, but you have to give Epstein in this front office credit for going out and getting guys like this that, you get one, not impressive. You get two or three or four, and one of them turns out, that's a great move. So any thoughts on Eddie Butler? He's got a good name.
Butler did it. And I have no thoughts on Eddie Butler. Isaac, did you have thoughts on Eddie Butler? I think Carlos kind of covered what I know about him. Other than him being a top prospect, that's kind of it.
Oh, did we lose Isaac?
I think we may have.
He had so much to say about Eddie Butler, which is a shame. But the way this is shaping up now, right, it looks like what we knew before, Montgomery will be the number five starter. And then you've got Brett Anderson, who's a proven major leaguer. You've got these other two young guys and a string of other young, more depth-based guys. Are you good in terms of this depth, or are you still looking for a move for maybe a more blue chippier prospect that's closer to the major league level? Or how do you feel right now about this level of depth?
I think for 2018, yeah. Maybe looking for somebody who can kind of step in and fill that Arrieta role. Once he's inevitably gone.
No pressure.
For 2017, yeah, I think it's perfectly fine. They've got five regular starters. They've got Brett Anderson, who's going to give you four starts and sit on the DL the rest of the year. I mean, come on. I'm rooting for the guy. I want him to do well, but he's had like two healthy seasons out of like 7 years in his career. He's never on the mound. I don't know how anyone can expect that he's actually going to be out there. But what I'm really interested in is looking at for 2018, what they have locked in. You've got Lester. And then after that, it's Strizny, Butler. I mean, you actually, before it was, what do they have behind Lester and Hendricks? It's absolutely nothing. There are question marks and nothing else. Now, you can make an argument that that might be a bad rotation or, you know, oh, you don't want to be starting Eddie Butler and, Alec Mills, but at least we know. At least there's somebody. There are guys that they could plug in until some of the other names that, you know, might have a little bit more promise in their arms start coming up through the farm system. So the Cubs have set themselves up with these recent flurry of under the radar moves for some pitching to actually have some actual pitching on the mound in 2018. So that's a little bit heartening.
Yeah, I think the point you're making, Ryan, is, and I hate to do it twice in a podcast, but to continue gushing over this front office, that hey, it's time to repeat. Here comes 2017. What can they do? How they've done all the work ahead of time to be positioned for, you know, to do great stuff again this year. But you're right. What they're doing here is getting a bunch of young depth, and really not using that. They're collecting the steps not for this year, but they're collecting it to see who could potentially fill in for the guys that are leaving next year. And it just goes to show that, you know, they're always kind of thinking ahead, and it's, you know, hats off again. I hate to be the pro front office guy all the time, but it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really argue with what the Cubs have done over the last few years outside of bringing a World Series championship to Chicago. I think that they haven't made a lot of wrong moves, so there's not a lot to argue with. They've earned some benefit of the doubt. So, the thing we harped on for so long of, you know, who are the guys who step up into the starting rotation in 2018. I think now we have a little bit more of an answer. Of course, fans would probably say if you're going to let Ian and Jake Arrieta go, you're going to have to replace them with someone a little bit better than Eddie Butler and Alec Mills. But at least we have an idea. They could probably fill out a starting rotation. So that's probably a good place to wrap on this, since we've got robot voice Isaac and writing the best speeches, just the best.
No, yeah, that makes sense. We again, if you guys have any questions, listeners, any questions, topics that you guys want to hear us cover, let us know. You can reach us on Twitter, BP Wrigleycast. You can email us at bpwrigleycast@baseballprospectus.com. We love hearing from you. Baseball is coming soon, so we'll ramp up for that. But in the meantime, send us any feedback, and we love to talk about that stuff on the air. So, Ryan, thank you for being here.
Absolutely. I do have one quick note. Since now that spring training is starting, we're probably going to be a little more regular with the podcast, but
yes.
I don't imagine that we're going to be recording next week, barring any kind of big moves. So I wanted to say 1 week from today is our 1 year anniversary on this podcast. Aww.
Really?
Yeah, we recorded our very first episode on February 15th.
Oh, wow.
February 8th. We have 1 week.
We might have to record just for that.
Yeah, we may have to actually do it. So
5.9 million listens later. No, I'm exaggerating.
5.9 listens later.
All right. Well, tune in next time, and thanks for listening. See you. Good night.
Good night.